The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 18, Episode 2, where Bob sat down with Susan Simpson to discuss the new season of Proof. This week, we are sans Janet, but Bob and I are here to discuss your listener questions. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
There's nothing. This is going to be, I think, well, every time I say this, it ends up being an hour long, but it feels like it's going to be a short follow-up. We don't really have any housekeeping. There's nothing going on right now. It's been a crazy week here. I know it has been like kind of nationwide weather-wise.
Yeah.
I keep hearing that, but I'm too selfish to be focused on our own blizzard that we've been under for 3 weeks now.
Mm-hmm.
I was away at a conference. I scooted back just in time to do this. Janet, poor Janet, smashed her laptop while she's in the middle of Sketchfest, so she's busy taking care of that. Only got a couple of questions from listeners, but I want to, what do you think? I made an executive decision when editing this podcast.
About leaving the child in?
And it was leaving Susan's child in it for a number of reasons. One, I just thought it was adorable.
It is adorable.
But also, it was when I was working on editing it, because we had some scheduling issues, so I actually edited this one. Usually Erica does all the editing. I was thinking, like, Susan is such a freaking badass.
Yeah.
And is so good at what she does. And then it was like, I think it's cool for people to hear she's doing it while also doing that.
Most of the podcasts I listen to, I love the rawness of some of it. Like there is time for those like super clean interviews, mm-hmm, and those super clean conversations. But sometimes when there's just like a genuine conversation,
yeah,
I really enjoy like the off stuff, like her coming through, her having to move. Not this episode, but there was an episode with Bob Mata and the dog barked. You know what I mean? Yeah, just like things where you're just like, I don't know. I love the trueness of the atmosphere of interviews like that.
It's very real. And I just thought, I felt like it was missing something genuine if I removed it. And it was, and so for those of you that didn't, the patrons have the video version of it, Patreon, which I highly recommend you guys checking out if you didn't. So she records in a hallway. And so what was happening was her daughter was, there's a door, two doors behind her. And her daughter kept going through from out this door and through that way. And just kept crossing behind her. And it was like, door closed, door closed, door closed, door closed. It was fucking hilarious. It kept happening over and over again. And the funniest part, I wish I had still been recording. I had just hit stop on the recording. And she's like, oh, God, I hope, what's the camera angle? Could you see her? I'm like, we could just see the top of her head. She's like, okay, good. Like, why? And she said, because that last time she went through, the reason I was stuttering was because she went through this way and she had pants on. And then when she went back through the other way, she didn't. So I have no fucking idea what happened in that room.
Yeah. I love moments in podcasts like that because it really humanizes somebody, especially somebody like Susan Simpson, who you really don't get. You know, you see this badass side of her. You don't get the mom side of her. You don't get, so I love those little things like that. It's such a cool thing.
Yeah. And it's just, I don't know. To me, it was just like, it makes like just having doing that interview with her made me just appreciate so much more like how incredible she is, because that's a lot that we've had little kids like
yes.
that. We know what it's like to be, and that's why I had, it's just, she said, this is why I need to get a recording shed like you had like back in the day.
Yes.
Like, that's why I did it. Cause I had little kids then and I couldn't do it in the house.
Oh man. Those were crazy days too. The recording shed was a crazy day. Cause you had the window, you had to peek through to make sure no one was doing anything. Like, right. Are you recording? Can I open the door? Oh,
yep. And the lawn tractor with the dog shit on the tires always made it miserable for my guests.
Oh man. What a fun episode though. It was really nice to hear Susan and to see her in that element. It was cool.
Yeah.
Really cool.
It was cool. And then, but what's not fun at all is luckily we're recording this on Tuesday. So the second episode of Proof has dropped. So I've listened to both.
Yes.
I did too. I was listening all day today while I was driving in the blizzard and then snow plowing. When I got home, I got through both of the first two episodes. And one, so good. Two, so freaking heartbreaking.
Yeah, it really, really was. I mean, you know, you hear it in the episode where Susan's talking about the issue with, you know, with him passing. If you guys haven't heard, spoiler alert,
yeah,
with him passing. But to just hear it in real time in the podcast and to know, I mean, it was days. And then to hear his wife talk, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. call her. Oh my goodness. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah. It's, Jessica in our chat says that if you listen to this week's episode, the way Earl was described in the murder just broke my heart. But that whole situation for those, you know, for, if you haven't listened yet without really spoiling anything, you know, the bike shop murders, because I didn't know any of this.
Mm-hmm.
I read a little bit before I talked to her about the bike shop murders, and I didn't get into that kind of detail that Susan and Jacinda got into. It sounded like this bike shop that was such this like kind of famous place in Kalamazoo was attached to their house, and the two brothers were just like hermits.
Mm-hmm.
Like they made it sound like they never ever ever leave that house.
Yeah, it did.
They're
kind
always
of
sound
like
there. Yeah.
And the idea of like in the episode when she talks about all the locks on the doors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, like the multitude of locks and the steel. I mean, just. That's kind of strange. Like, not just for the fact that there was a murder there, but for somebody to live that way.
Well, and I think it's because, you know, they talked about when he was attacked years before, if that's when they would in. And mm-hmm. I'm assuming the metal bar is like a Charlie bar.
Yeah, that's what it sounded like.
Yeah, that you put over to keep something from the door from sliding open. But I don't want to give away spoilers, but in episode two, when they talked to the cop that was a witness in episode two,
mm-hmm.
that and Jesus Christ, man, if you guys haven't listened to Proof yet, like you have got to go listen to it. Like, they are such a great combination, Jacinda and mm-hmm. Susan, because like, you know, Susan does what Susan does as an investigator and attorney, and it just nothing gets by her. And she's bold and she'll talk to anybody. Like, she's not like, I've been on the streets working on cases with Susan before, and she gives zero fucks. Like, she is a badass. But then you have Jacinda, who is a filmmaker, in that filmmaking production quality comes through in the pot. Like, it's so like just the sound design,
mm-hmm.
everything from the scoring to narration, cut with interview, cut to narration, cut to interview, cut to narration, cut to interview. And we're hearing from all these people. Like, it's just so good. Like, I'm just enthralled with every minute of it.
Yeah. It's really good. And man, that moment too of talking to that officer without when he says he believes Jeff Titus was innocent.
Yeah.
And then he goes, and another one. And they're like, what?
Yeah. And then Susan guesses it.
Yeah.
Which one it is.
Yeah. Immediately. Which is the whole idea about that cold case too, like the whole cold case unit in Kalamazoo and the mm-hmm. idea that they solved as many cold. That's questionable in my eyes.
100%. They solved 100% of the cold cases.
Yeah.
In what, 7 years?
Yeah. That's
all of them.
That's unfathomable to me.
Yeah. And like, I thought Susan put it really well when she was like, so every one of these cases are cases that had the full force of the investigative detective bureau investigating them and couldn't figure them out. And then these guys come around and solve every single one of them.
Yeah. And you get confessions from everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This season is going to be, I think it's going to be in way longer than she thinks it is.
Yeah.
As they're just from these first two episodes when they're picking away at the couple cases that we heard about three of them
yeah
already.
Well, and it, I mean, this is going way back, but it almost reminds me of like your season two of Truth and Justice, where it starts one direction and then it just unravels into a pile of other things.
Well, that's why I said to her, I don't remember if I made the interview cutter. And I was like, it was like when I went into Smith County, like
if I went you said that I don't recall it, but
it was like I go into East Texas to interview, to investigate originally Kenny Snow's case. And then we were there for years, you know, from that same department, that same part of the state anyway. Yeah. What amazed me is, how the fuck did you, and I have to, I wish I had heard it before I was able to interview her. So I'm like, how did you get the cold case investigators to come on bragging about this shit? Yeah. That's insane. Yeah. It's bananas. The jackasses that put Jeff Titus in prison, the guys that, that put Scott Baldwin in prison, the guys that did all this are like in there going, yeah, we did pretty good. Yeah, we solved 100% of them. That's pretty damn good at success rate. We were great. And they just, and then, that was, granted, those original interviews you hear were from 2020, but then when she said she went back and is talking to him again, now it's like, I don't know how she got him to talk to her.
Yeah, it's...
And how are they still so fucking arrogant?
It's wild. And the, again, no spoilers here, but the idea that when they arrested Scott, that they said, this will get us back on 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what? What? Come on, guys.
Yeah, and of course the recordings are all gone.
Yeah.
But it's just, this is, I'm actually jealous of Susan and Jacinda being able to, like, work cases, like, they're able to dedicate all their time to it, mm-hmm. and they're working, and there's just, like, this string of cases. And that's the difference between, you know, people that are doing, like, unsolved cases, and these are all, because they're all closed, and Michigan is pretty good about, unlike Indiana, as we discussed on the podcast, and we dealt with Bynum's case. Michigan's pretty good about giving, if the case is closed, you can get the records,
mm-hmm.
you can get them, and they're able to like to pick through and parse through, and like Susan doesn't miss shit. Like these detectives are fucked.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you, and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
The whole idea of this too is really upsetting to me by the fact of like, you know, when you've covered these cases, like season two, we're in Texas. We're not here. We're in Texas. This is bad things are happening in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to like, you know, our season 16 is local.
Yeah.
Our season 17 is within an hour.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Susan and Jacinda are putting out a podcast within an hour of our, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, it's all in our backyard.
These are all in our backyard. This shit is continuing to happen, which means this is happening everywhere.
Yeah.
It's not just some localized thing somewhere. Like, it's terrifying.
Yeah, I was shocked. I mean, I knew Jeff Titus's case was from Kalamazoo, but mm-hmm. when I found season three was like this whole cold case investigation. I mean, and Amy in our chat just said, I'll admit that it's stuff like this that makes me question all those cold case files shows so that we've all seen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they're in those shows, what are they? They're always the heroes.
Right.
The cold case team came in and solved the case.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some. There's instances where they genuinely solve these cold cases and mm-hmm. get justice for people, and it's great. Yeah. But when you have, like, anybody that has 100% clearance rate should be putting up red flags.
Yeah.
And she hasn't got into it yet, unless I missed it, but I'm curious, because she said that the unit only existed for 7 years.
I did notice that it was a very short time period. In my opinion, a very short time period.
And I'm wondering, and I don't think I missed it yet. I don't think she explained why. Like, why did they, you put a cold case unit in to close cold cases, and they close 100% of them. 100% of them end in a conviction. Why would you close it unless there's a problem?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that she's addressed that, but that's a really good question.
Yeah. 'Cause
why would you? If you're truly having this success rate, that seems unreasonable to close down. You're clearly, something's working if it's true.
Right.
Something's working.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but that, yeah, 100% is crazy.
Sue said in the chat, this is definitely getting them famous again.
That's for sure.
Probably not the way they want to. And it's, again, like the arrogance when they're, I mean, because those interviews they're doing in episode 2 when they're talking to the cold case detectives, these interviews were after, if I understand right, after Jeff Titus was exonerated.
That's, I do believe so.
And they're still with that same attitude about all of this.
It's disgusting.
And they clearly don't know who they're messing with.
They have
no idea. They have no idea that any shortcut they took is going to get exposed. Because that other, in Scott's case, like that DNA that she talked about, like how does that not, he's beaten to death.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to figure out what I'm spoiling or not, but she mentioned this on the show, so we're good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's beaten to death. They find male DNA under both his fingernails on both hands that both come back to the same person that are neither Scott or the victim. And the prosecution is still making an argument that that doesn't exonerate him?
Yeah. I don't understand that.
Yeah, I don't understand. Like
especially in an area like fingernails. Like you talked about in the episode, cases like Jamie Snow's case, there's a high traffic area. I can understand the argument that the DNA could be irrelevant.
Yeah.
But a case like this, where it's like clearly it's a brutal murder. There's DNA under the fingernails.
Which is where you look.
Which is definitely where you look.
Uh-huh.
Like, and to not think that that has any relevance to the case is insane to me.
No, this is, and it's, I know it's beating a dead horse, particularly to our audience, but like, it's when I'm always like, what is wrong with these prosecutors that like, were they, that you can't admit you got this wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can't admit that when there's the clear and convincing evidence staring you straight in the face that you got this one wrong. I'll never understand that mindset.
It's terrifying. It's terrifying that these people will continue to do this and continue to push for the fact that they're not wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that clearly, no matter what you put in front of them, they're like, no, this is exactly what's supposed to be.
Well, and you know, for me, going through all the classes I'm going through right now with my criminal justice degree, it's like, I'm from the cop side of it. It's like, I'm doing all this work and research on what is supposed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So I can confirm that these officers are being taught to do things right. Like I've not taken, in case you were wondering, I've not taken one class where it's like, sometimes the end justifies the means. Like most of the classes that I have to take, very few of the classes I've taken up until now. Now I'm in my final phase of where I'm taking forensic psychology classes and crime scene reconstruction classes and stuff like that. Prior to this, the overwhelming majority of the coursework in a criminal justice degree is there's three different ethics classes you have to take, you know, and they go through all the different like models like utilitarianism and ends justifies the means and the slippery slope and like all like that's like there is a heavy focus in the education to get a criminal justice degree telling you how all of those things are wrong, how they are, we don't do it. And how, and the big thing is, and of course, with current events today, I see the way that, you know, administration is like talking about all the incidents that we've all been talking about right now. And I just keep thinking like how, and again, I think I mentioned this before, most of the research I use, most of the sources I use are Department of Justice handbooks and publications.
Mm-hmm.
Those are my academic sources I use for most of the papers and stuff that I write. And every single one of them, in every class I'm taking, always comes back to maintaining your legitimacy and credibility with your citizens and how important, and like I swear to God, every paper I write ends with, when you don't do this, then you break down credibility and you break down trust with the community, which violates everything that we stand for.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, and it's amazing to me then when I go see cops doing this shit. It's like, where does that mentality come from? I think back to like the Andrew Collins interview.
I was just thinking about that.
Yeah. And it was such a good look at from the inside of how someone went into it with the best intentions mm-hmm. and got sucked into the bad
stuff. I was literally just thinking about that interview with Andrew Collins. Yeah. Because he says that. He's like, I never intended. I wanted to go help people. Mm-hmm. I never intended to do the things I was doing.
Yeah.
But it's a slippery slope.
Interesting. So Teresa asked me if they teach the read technique. I was just thinking about, because I'm almost done, and I have not, in my coursework, have not had any classes on interrogation techniques. I've had a lot of classes on like constitutional law and what you can do, but I have nothing about the read technique, nothing interrogation techniques. Now, I don't know if that's because, now the read technique is a course offered by the Reed Institute mm-hmm. outside of college classes. I don't know if because my focus is criminology, if that's why I never got a class in interrogation techniques, because it's not part of criminology. Criminology
is interesting.
Crime scene investigation, crimes, you know, it has more to do with, you know, everything from profiling to crime scene reconstructions to evidence, processing evidence, everything like that. It's that piece of it. Mm-hmm. Stuff that's more, it has a lot more to do with what I do. But yeah, it's a good question because they have not taught the read technique. So I don't know if that's something that happens at the police academy but just like when you go to, you know, just like any other, you know, I was just at a conference doing all kinds of professional development, like mm-hmm. for, you know, if you're going to be a detective, you got to go get certified in the read technique.
Maybe.
It's an outside certification. But yeah, I'm going to look through the course. That's a good question, Teresa. I'm going to look through my course catalog and see if that is a course that is offer that I just didn't get because it didn't fit my focus area.
That's really strange. Mm-hmm. So I have a question for you, and I don't know if you can answer it, but kind of based around this whole idea of the cold case unit, what do you think, like, this cold case unit in particular boasts that they have this 100% success rate. What do you think a standard success rate for a cold case unit is? I mean, it has to be very low.
I would think, and I'm just pulling off the top of my head, I would think that if a cold case unit is clearing with conviction 10 to 15% of their cases, mm-hmm. that would be legit. Because what you got to consider is it's not just that here's a unit that takes on cases and investigates them. It's a unit that takes on cases and investigates them that have already been investigated by an entire detective bureau. Mm-hmm. So you have to think like, you know, and that's very different from, I always say the reason why I've always focused on wrongful convictions is because if it is a wrongful conviction, then that means the investigators were looking in the wrong direction the whole time. And there's an entire other investigative path that they never went down because they got the wrong guy. So there's a lot of ground to cover there. But in a cold case, presumably the police were not solving it. So they were trying every angle and were unable to come up with the answers. Now, I think that if you're looking at cold cases where it's like it happened in the 70s before there was DNA testing and they're running DNA and solving them, that's different. But if you're looking at cases like this where, you know, it was done post DNA testing had already been done on it or whatever the case may be, and they're just by knocking on doors and interviewing witnesses, like, I would say 10%, and it's just a guess, but
That even feels high.
Yeah.
I mean, and maybe I'm not. Maybe it's, I don't know, but that feels high, even 10%. Mm-hmm. So to even imagine 100% is just, what a fallacy.
Yeah. Sue asked a good question here. So she said, what education does it take to be a cop? I'm never sure. Also never sure about elected sheriff's backgrounds. Yeah. So that varies. And I didn't think that there was any requirement for like a college degree. But one of the assignments I actually had to do in last semester, I had to interview two veteran police officers about education and how, where they see its value in the police service. It was actually in an ethics class. So we were talking about like, do you think like ethical behavior from officers is improved from officers that have a formal education? But in doing that, both the cops that I talked to and interviewed, they both said the same thing, that they both had 4-year college degrees. And they said when they got on, which they're both 25-year veterans of the police force. When they got on, it was very competitive to try to get a job as a cop. And so most agencies, like the better agencies, so think in our area, right? And for those of you listening to season 15, you know, St. Joe and Benton Harbor, the Twin Cities, they're right next to each other, but very different makeups and demographics and money.
Yeah.
So the one, I won't say his last name, but Chris, you know, Chris.
Yes.
So he just retired from St. Joe. And he said when he got hired there, they required a bachelor's degree in criminal justice to even apply. Across the river in Benton Harbor, they had no such requirement. And so when I was asking about that, he said there's never been a state requirement that you have to have a 4-year degree to get a police officer. You can graduate high school, get hired, get sent to the police academy, and that's it. When it was competitive, the departments that were very desirable for people to want to work in would put in that requirement. And he said now over the years, there's still those more desirable departments now have a bachelor's degree preferred. So it's not required, but when they get their applications in, if they're hiring two spots and 7 of the applicants have bachelor's degree and the rest don't, they're only going to interview the 7. They're going to work on, you know, from that angle. But he said a lot of them, they're just taking whoever they can get nationwide because there's a, you know, there's not a lot of people want to be cops right now.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with like teachers, right? And the teacher qualifications, like, do you guys know I can only speak to Michigan, but in Michigan, there are 3 different programs where you can get hired as a full-time teacher and start teaching kids right out of high school with no college degree.
Really?
And there are programs where, like, basically I'm going to sign this contract with a school. The school participates in the statewide program. They are going to pay for you to go to college to get your degree while you're working. And then you have to work for them for 5 years after that's done or something like that. There's programs that are like that. But there's like a time limit on it where it's like within 6 years or 5 years, whatever it is, you have to have a valid teaching certificate or you're done.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you can, like, without any college degree at all, and then there's other ones where if you have a bachelor's degree in anything, you can start teaching right away, and then they'll send you to get your teaching certificate.
Interesting.
Stuff like that. And it's because there's not a lot, nobody wants to be a teacher right now either. Teachers, a nationwide teacher shortage. It's the same thing with cops. So yeah, it's a good question. It's never been required to have college, but it's always been one of those things where it's going to help you get the job. But the less people that want the job, the less those requirements exist.
Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link your accounts, and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Well, do you want to get into the few listener questions that we do have?
Yeah. And look at that. We managed to yap for 25 minutes.
Oh, it's great. So our first question comes from Faith. Can someone officially, legally be exonerated posthumously? Would his estate have any legal recourse?
Yeah. So the answer is yes, but it very much varies by state and jurisdiction. And I heard Susan, when I saw that question, I feel like I remember Susan saying in this episode that they can't litigate his case after he's dead. I remember that coming up.
Okay.
I did look up, and in Michigan, you can in Michigan have a conviction vacated posthumously, you know, after someone's dead with new evidence. But even with that, I only had a few minutes to research this, so I'm not entirely sure of it. But that is also based on jurisdiction. So it could be what Susan was referring to was maybe in Kalamazoo County, if they're like, they won't put the resources in, you can't file a motion for a dead person and that's it. But we've seen it happen. I mean, in other places, and if you guys remember way back, like season 2, Corey Sessions, who's part of the Innocence Project of Texas, his brother, Tim Cole, I believe was his name, was exonerated posthumously. And there's like a statue of him. We did a whole episode on it where, he died in prison and then they eventually proved that he was innocent.
But is there any legal recourse for his family or?
I'm sure that has to do with jurisdiction and everything else. But, you know, if you're in, I don't know, because, right, so if you're in Texas has a law in place that if you are exonerated due to actual innocence, that they'll pay you, I think it's $80,000. For every year you were wrongfully incarcerated, and then 40 grand a year for the rest of your life. Kerry Max Cook just got exonerated, and they probably owed him about $2 million from the years and decades that he spent in prison for a crime he didn't commit. I don't know if that would apply to a family, and I don't know if you could file a lawsuit on it. I don't know if there's any case law on that. I'm not sure.
It's a strange thing to think about because I just don't, it doesn't seem like there would be a ton of legal recourse they could have.
It would be hard to, I'm just thinking through, like practically speaking, it makes sense. And for legally speaking, it would be hard. I was thinking about that Texas situation, right? So that's supposed to be, we took 30 years of your life. And so here's $2.4 million for you to be able to live the rest of your life. You know, it's based on, you know, what an average mean income would be. Have you been out working during that time? How you make that argument that someone else on the outside, how they can show that them being incarcerated. I mean, you could, again, practically speaking, you'd be like, well, that was my spouse. You take like Ed and Kim, right? So Kim, they stayed married the whole time. Kim had lived without her husband's income for 20 years. You know, you could make the argument, but I don't know.
So our next one is more of a statement, but it's from Julia. It says, I listened to her episode right after the interview and it was truly heartbreaking. I hope they get him exonerated. The best part, however, was Susan's child interrupting her at every turn. It made me smile. Go, Susan. You're an amazing lawyer and an even better mom.
100% agree.
Yeah, I love that we talked about it at the top of the episode too, because it's such a neat thing. So Camilla has two questions, kind of statements, but questions. So here we go. Did not expect to be crying immediately from the start of the season, but it is just so unfair and heartbreaking that not only did someone steal the life of the person murdered, investigators decided to steal another life from someone innocent. And I'm only assuming, since we're just at the start, this is not another notch in your solved cases statistics. It's a human being.
Yeah. And I wish that they would all think that way.
Yeah. And it's hard. She's got another question. I'll get there in a moment. But you do see that sometimes with these cases where they dehumanize these people so bad. You know, we saw it kind of in our missing persons season.
Yeah.
Where they would dehumanize these people so bad, and you forget that they're a mother, they're a father, they're a brother, it's sad to see that they just want to throw them away as a criminal.
Before you hit Camilla's other question, I saw AJ in the chat says, in Michigan, neither exoneration nor setting aside a conviction is available for a defendant who is not alive. However, in rare cases, family members or legal representatives may petition for posthumous exoneration, but it's highly discretionary and requires strong evidence. Thank you very much, AJ, for that information.
All right. And Camilla's next one is, Bob, if you're considering covering a case and found out the person sitting in prison is likely to die soon, death row or terminal illness, would that impact your decision and in what way?
I thought about this a lot while I was talking to Susan, and it would definitely impact my decision. It would depend on a lot of circumstances, I think. So you're wrestling with a couple of different things. One, I think I would feel, if I truly thought the person was innocent, I would feel a deep, like, moral obligation to keep fighting for that person, to clear their name, because it's important. You know, even when they're gone, for their family or whatever, and it would be important to me to be able to do that, you know, for like what Susan's doing. Like, if she's able to clear Scott Baldwin's name after he died, like, that's incredible. You know, it's I want to say life changing, but it's not life. But I mean, it's something you can hang your hat on, that you did something good. You know what I mean? And that's a thing that's important to me, is that I get that someday when I'm retired, that I can look back on my career and be able to say, like, I did something good for society. I used my time on this planet to impact lives and do something good. And that absolutely falls into that category. The thing I would wrestle with is, if I have other cases and other people that are asking me to help them that are still in prison and alive, that's where I would have the struggle, is, do I keep putting all of my energy into this case when the person's already deceased? And because of that, I'm not able to put any energy into this other person's case that's still alive and in prison. So that would be the struggle. I don't know why this is, as I'm looking at you, I just realized there's a picture of me and Susan on the wall right there from Baltimore. I don't know why, I just noticed that.
That's fun.
Good times. Me, Susan, Robbie, and Colin hanging out in Baltimore.
No, I think that's a very, very tough decision to make, and especially moving forward. You know, and you kind of had to make that decision in season 8.
Yeah.
You made the final decision, but we definitely all sat and talked about
what to do.
What to do and what path to take.
Yeah. And that was one of those, it was same thing, right? I hope you guys, you know, whether you agree with me or disagree with me and whatever I'm talking about and whatever soapbox I happen to be on at the moment, I hope that you all have gotten over these 11 years that I'm trying to do what's best, and I'm always trying to do the right thing. And I stress a lot about what is the right thing in so many different situations. And that was one of them. And ultimately with that one, it came down to that was, it was, do I keep putting effort into her case when it's not going to affect her? Cause she's gone. Mm-hmm. Just like I was just saying, at the same time, we could see this thing through and finish the end. Ultimately, what it came down to for me was, in her case, I wasn't fully convinced that she was innocent. And she may have been. Mm-hmm. She may have been. I'm not saying she is guilty or was guilty. I'm saying at that point, I wasn't convinced. And then I started playing this out. Like, what if I spend the next 6 months putting all this energy into the case only to find out at the end that she is in fact guilty? And then what could I have been doing during that time?
Correct.
You know, because I'm always wrestling too. Like, as much as everything we do is about these wrongful convictions, my focus is always on getting justice for the victims. And it's like, if I did all that work and all that time and took time away from where I could have been helping someone else, only to find out that I was doing that for the person that took the lives of two people.
Right. Right. And I think the other end of that too was, didn't the Innocence Project of Texas ask you to look into that case?
Yeah. And it was a rare situation because they didn't, you know, when they brought me Jesse Eldridge's case, they brought it to me and said, he is innocent. We've got to find, like we've tried everything. We've got to find a way to fully investigate this and get him out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did. Hopefully, you know, fingers crossed, within the next year, he's going to be out. I'm praying and I truly believe that'll happen. As opposed to Perringer's case, which was, we've looked into this. We really can't, we don't see anything obvious saying she's innocent, but there's some problems with it. Look into this one and tell us if she's innocent so we can decide if we're going to put more resources into it.
Yeah.
So it was a different situation.
Well, Bob, what do we have coming up this next week?
Good question. I don't know.
Do you want to go a different way about that?
No, it's fine. This is the how the sausage is made. So we've had kind of a snowpocalypse here. We've had all kinds of stuff going on. I had to be away at a conference and I'm working. I was talking to Michael Osbrook, who's trying to get me in contact with Andrea Burkhart. And so I'm trying to get them on, one or both of them on this week, to update us on where the Delphi case is at, where Richard Allen's case is. And I didn't realize, so he had sent me here's a real inside baseball. He sent me a text last week and said, here's a screenshot of my conversation with Andrea. She should be reaching out to you. And I was like, cool. Didn't pay any attention to it. And then this weekend, when I'm getting ready to leave to go to a conference for 3 days, I was like, oh, I never heard from Andrea or Michael since then. And I looked and the screenshot, he said, okay, cool. Here's his contact information. Here's his phone number and his email address, neither of which were right.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I was like, oh, shit, Mike, that's not my email or my phone number.
Oh, no.
And I gave him the proper one. And then, so I texted Michael last night and was like, hey, because now it's Tuesday now. It's got to be Wednesday or Thursday to get this thing done. Is she going to be available, or you, or I've got to come up with something else real quick on the fly? So, yeah, I don't know yet. It's just one of these insane weeks where I'm trying to figure it out, but we'll have something for you.
I laughed during the episode, and this is 100% behind-the-scenes stuff, but in the episode, and you'll appreciate this, when she was talking about being able to make the episode in time, and then she's like, it's really hard to make it on the fly.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's all you used to talk about was white-knuckle podcasting. Mm-hmm. You and Mike, white-knuckle podcasting.
Yep.
Every week having to not only research an episode, put an episode together.
Write it, edit it.
Yes.
Music, the whole thing.
All in real time.
Yeah. Which is what we've been doing now for 11 years, mm-hmm. over 1,000 episodes, which is why we've made the format where every other season we just take a little break.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it's a grind. I love it, but yeah, it can wear you out sometimes.
Yeah.
With that, Zach's got a big snowy drive home. It's almost 9 o'clock our time. But thanks everybody for tuning in. Thanks everybody for the chat. Great chat today. Over 50 of you in there watching along with us. If you guys are ever interested, make sure follow us on social media. We tell you when we're doing this live on YouTube. You can always join in, add questions as we go. And we'll have something for you on Sunday. And whatever that something is, we'll talk about it next week.
I love it.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.